This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Well, you've probably had this experience, right? You wake up in a hotel room and you're completely disoriented. Like, where am I, right? Which kind of leads you to wonder how you do know where you are when you wake up in your own home. And where does that map of your bedroom, the one that opens up in your brain, come from? The one that opens up before your eyes open in bed? The way our brains organize space and measure distance requires a lot of coordination of sensory input from the big wide world out there and neural activity within the brain itself. And Duke professor Jennifer Groh thinks that learning about these processes offers insights into more than just the mystery of how we know where we left our keys or how to find the bathroom. She thinks it might hold keys to the nature of thought itself. Her new book is called Making Spaces, How the Brain Knows Where Things Are. Jennifer Groh is a professor at the Center for Cognitive Neuroscience at Duke University and joins us now. Welcome to the show. Good to have you here.
Thank you very much.
So let's take that example I opened with, this sort of this not knowing where you are, or better yet, knowing where you are. What's happening when I wake up and I get a map or don't get a map of where I slept last night?
Well, the thing that intrigues me about that that whole process is the number of different pieces of information that our brains have to put together to achieve that kind of knowledge. So you know where you are because you walked into your bedroom the night before. Well, walking provides you some information about where you are in space. There are some studies that have shown that, for example, ants walking around through the desert, that is pretty much a featureless kind of environment, that they actually count their steps to keep track of where they are. We also use our sense of balance to keep track of our head turns with respect to gravity. So that helps us retain a sense of orientation. And, of course, the obvious is vision, being able to see where you are. And in a familiar environment, that's a particularly good cue to use to know where you are.
You also talk about pressure on your skin, which I had never really thought about, as one of these very important cues both for forming the memory and then calling it back up at the appropriate moment.
That's right. So I think, you know, a complete list of all the different ways that that we gather information about spatial information and at a variety of scales, you'd have to include vision. You include your sense of touch. We also have a sense of our body's own position and configuration. You know, you know when your arms are extended versus when they're crossed in front of you. Your sense of hearing helps you localize where sounds are coming from. All of these different types of information have to be integrated together and integrated with knowledge of our movements. Our movements are critical to this because they're what position our bodies and our sense organs with respect to the environment.
Well, we hardly ever think about this, but it's like when you're if you're driving along in a car, you have a pretty stable view of the world outside the window. If you put a pair of binoculars over your eyes and you hold them in your hands, it's a pretty jerky view, leading you to wonder, how did I get the stable view if my head's bouncing up and down like this?
That's right. Yeah, so your brain is actually constructing that the perception of having a stable environment, despite the fact that the actual incoming sensory input is you know, changing all the time.
It's kind of paying attention to the fact that my head's moving up and down. So it takes that into account, kind of cancels that out and says, if your head weren't moving, this is what the world would look like.
Exactly.
So when I hold the binoculars in my arms, it's now my arms that are moving. And the brain's going, wait, I'm not doing arms. They're longer than the head. I can't. This is a hard thing. So you're just going to get a jerky world.
That's right. And knowing arm position is more challenging than knowing head position because you carry things of different weights with your arms. And so measuring the amount of force that your muscles have to apply to hold your arms in a particular position isn't sufficient to tell you what position they're actually in, because a different amount of force will be required for the same position depending on how much you're holding.
And so this is important if we get back to our waking up in the hotel analogy. So I'm also, you know, I've always kind of imagined that what's going on is just like opening a document on my hard drive, right? I mean, I saved it. And then it doesn't matter where I am or what computer I'm on. If I open that document, it will open up and I'll have the same thing that I saved. But this suggests that there's something about what the feeling, the senses that are awakening with me, the feel of my bed against my back, the ambient sound of my room, that really helps construct the picture. It's not just any old saved file. It's a saved file with help from the current input.
And you could say that maybe it's those cues are helping you know which file to open. That, you know, you've got many different files. You've been in many different places in the world and throughout your life, but knowing which one is the right one is from your sensory input.
And so you point this out, especially when you talk about art, too. You know, some famous, like you've got a Renoir painting in here, mm-hmm. where it's not always clear where our subjects are looking, right? And that's kind of part of the beauty of the painting. But you suggest that there is that the way the light is, you know, sort of bouncing off of the objects on the table is another cue to the viewer that we may not have paid attention to.
That's right. So the optics of our eyes allow us to detect what direction light is coming from. And that's useful because light comes from directions in a patterned way based on the locations of objects out there in the world. And it's not something we think about because it's just so automatic to us. But it actually took scholars about 2,000 years to work out all the pieces of how that happens. You had to know what is light, what is it that our eyes are seeing. And the ancient Greeks weren't at all sure what was going on. And some of them thought that light, that vision occurred by our eyes sending something out into the world and kind of probing the world as if by touch. And others felt like, no, it's something coming from the world into the eye, and that's how vision works.
And then, of course, you get back to the idea that you suggested earlier, which is that it all gets constructed in the head, that really we could be very suspicious of what's actually going on out there since the brain does so much manipulating and filtering and measuring against right previous templates.
That's right. That's right. So back to the Renoir and the different directions that the characters in that painting are looking. So we actually move our eyes about 3 times a second, and we move our eyes at a very rapid rate of speed. They're moving at speeds of rotation of about 500 degrees per second. So that means that if your eyes could actually, you know, swing around your head, they'd be going around the head 1.5 times in the space of a second. And, you know, you're doing this all the time. Like, you know, if you're listening to this program as you're driving along the highway, your eyes are constantly jerking about. So our brains have to, and the reason you do that is because we actually see clearly only in the very center of our field of view. So by moving our eyes, we get to aim that sort of high megapixel, high resolution camera at different targets of interest. But to create that sense of visual stability, our brains have to staple together those different snapshots of the visual scene, and they have to be laid out in the correct relationship to each other. So you have to know exactly where you directed your eyes. You have to,
and where you are at
where
the moment,
you are.
Right?
Yeah.
So it matters how far you are, and distance is one of the calculations being made through this visual experience. Right?
That's right. That's right.
And then we're tracking all the stuff. So you think if I'm looking at a bird, I'm looking at a bird. But no, you're not. First of all, you're distinguishing the bird from the tree, and that's no small feat itself, right?
That's right. That's right. And that's also a spatial calculation that your brains have to perform. As early as the retina, there are calculations that the brain is performing that are helping you to distinguish the bird from the tree. So the way you do that is to try to find areas of the visual scene where things are changing. So you try to identify the boundaries and borders of objects. And there's circuitry in the retina that begins to emphasize areas where the pattern of light and dark is changing.
This leads to this leads to some of these big Zen questions. So stand by. But here's the thing: like to see anew, to see everything as though it were for the first time, right? Which we'd love to do, we simply don't. If that's we look up and it's a bird.
Right.
And maybe if it's a red bird, we'll take notice and say, oh, isn't that pretty? Otherwise, we'll say it's a bird. Is there something about memory? In other words, do I get just enough information to say, yeah, I've seen that before, and you pull up the file film instead of the thing in front of you?
That's right. Yeah. So our brains are constantly filling in based mm-hmm. on estimates, based on memories, based on templates, based on you know, what you can see in the surroundings. So, for example, we all have blind spots on the retina. There's a little gap in our photoreceptor mosaic where the optic nerve leaves the retina and heads back into the brain. But none of us routinely perceive a gap in vision at the location of these blind spots. Now, partly that's because you've got two eyes open at the same time, and so one eye is covering for the other. But you know, you can blink one eye or wink, and you still won't see the blind spot.
I was bowled when I learned about the persistence of vision, the fact that we have a bunch of snapshots that we actually construct in the head as continuous motion. I just about couldn't get up the next day. Like, what could be happening in that frame where I wasn't paying attention? There could have been a whole universe of activity.
That's right. That's right.
I lose sleep over stuff like that.
and you know, this is one reason why patients who are being screened for glaucoma have to go through a very careful visual field test, because they're not going to be aware of these gaps that they might have in vision when there's damage to the retina.
So your research in your book leads me to all of these great speculations and Zen koans and other kind of great mysteries. Are there practical applications? Are there ways in which people with various sensory deficits can benefit by what you know?
Well, yes. So I think one of the themes of the book is the degree to which these different sensory systems have to interact with each other and coordinate with each other. And, you know, they're covering for each other. So a good example of this is ventriloquism. So we are not as good at localizing sound as we are at localizing visual information. This is partly because the ear doesn't form a picture of the world the way the eye forms a picture of the visual world. Instead, you have to figure out where sounds are coming from by calculating subtle differences in how much louder a sound is in one ear versus the other, how much sooner it arrives there just based on the speed of sound. And these, you know, that timing difference is less than a millisecond. So it's a very short amount of time.
Well, that's good. That's why we have two ears, because then we'll know if it came to the right ear faster than it came to the left ear, it's on the right.
That's right. Yeah. Exactly. But that's just harder to do than to localize visual stimuli. And so vision appears to play a role in calibrating our sense of sound location and teaching us how to interpret those timing difference cues, those level difference cues, how to map those onto a real world position of a sound.
So these sensors, our senses then are not segregated.
They're not segregated at all. Yeah. So Aristotle came up with this idea of five distinct senses. But in fact, in the brain, the signals from each sensory system are interacting with signals from the other sensory systems.
And you talk about an artist who has learned to sort of reconstruct his own style after he became paraplegic and came up with a different way of creating, but the images are still very strong in his head, clearly from the work he does.
That's right, yeah. So I think you're referring to artist Chuck Close.
Right.
And one of the things that intrigues me about his paintings is that he makes these paintings that have sort of pixelated, but each pixel is not just a dot. It's an oriented contour. And that is exactly what neurons in our primary visual cortex have developed the ability to emphasize in terms of visual stimuli. So there are neurons in primary visual cortex that are most responsive when there's a contour of some kind at a particular location in space called their receptive field. And so some neurons like horizontal lines and other neurons like vertical lines and others like the various diagonals. And across the entire population of neurons, all of these different possible orientations will activate somebody in visual cortex. And so I really like Chuck Close's paintings because he's sort of drawing those specialized sensitivity patterns.
But that's what art does, isn't it? I mean, the whole idea of perspective, right? I mean, it took a while, and so once individuality, turns out that we see ourselves as individuals about the moment that this becomes part of what artists do. But perspective is a trick, right? I mean, that's a flat, two-dimensional canvas that's making us see three dimensions.
Right, absolutely. So the ability to draw in perspective and the sort of logic and geometry behind that was discovered in, I think, 16th century Italian art community. And one of the ways they did that was to use a mirror. So that you could draw on the mirror, so that you could draw the lines that were present in the visual scene, and they realized, aha, you know, lines sort of converge on a vanishing point in the horizon.
But this does bring us to the point of discussing thought and how the way we perceive distance and space does contribute to the way we think, because this was a moment in European history when economies were becoming more competitive, where the idea of one individual over and against another was becoming rewarded. And sure enough, artists are interested in creating a separation from the canvas in a way that they hadn't before. Nobody sat down. There was no committee meeting for how to merge capitalism and art. But by golly, didn't it happen together? So there is some way in which our thought process and our sense of space are linked.
That's right. So one of the things that has intrigued me for some time is, what is the connection between sensory and motor processing and thinking? And when you look at areas of the brain that are responsive to sensory and motor events or stimuli, what you find is that it's a very large proportion of the brain. So I start off the book with what has become a joke in the neuroscience world. You know, everybody laughs about the idea that you use X percent of your brain.
No, not X percent. 9/10 of your brain power. In your book, as a neuroscientist, you wrote 9/10 of your brain power is spent figuring out where things are.
Okay, but what's the next sentence?
Actually, I just made that number up. But it may be true. I love that. By the way, I love that a neuroscientist would just do all of that. And then in parentheses say, I just made it up. But it could be true.
Right. So it may actually be true. So if you look at how much of the brain is responsive to sensory and motor cues, it's a very large proportion. And I have no idea if it's 9/10 or if it's something other than that. But if sensory and motor processing were totally distinct from thinking or reasoning or, you know, things that don't seem to be connected to sensory and motor processing, then there just wouldn't be that much of the brain left over. And so that, you know, that got me personally thinking, and I started to learn more about what some of the people who work in cognitive science have been thinking about this. And there's a theory called grounded or embodied cognition, which suggests that when you are thinking, what you're doing is you are using your sensory and motor structures to kind of simulate some of the sensory and motor attributes of the concept that you're thinking. So, for example, if you're thinking about a cat, your visual cortex might be active to in patterns that are consistent with actually seeing a cat. Auditory cortex might be simulating what cats sound like. Somatosensory or touch cortex might be simulating what cats feel like. And, you know, maybe motor cortex is simulating what it's like to pet a cat, to pet your cat and feel its fur. So, and there's some evidence for this. There was a very nice study in which human subjects were presented with just lists of words. And the words related to body parts. So, for example, some of the words were like kick or lick. So kick would relate to your feet and lick would relate to your mouth. And they found, using a technique called functional magnetic resonance imaging, that there was enhanced activity in areas of the brain that were consistent with the body maps in our sensory and motor cortex.
So it's not just accessing some picture of a cat that you may have stored somewhere. The sense, the space, the distinction of cat from cat's basket, all of those things are located in different parts of the brain.
That's right.
All associated with the actual action or the framing of the space.
Right. That's right. Now, I should say this is a theory, and we really don't know for sure that this is the way things work, but I find it a very appealing theory that is consistent with this observation that there's a lot of the brain that is involved in sensory and motor processing. And it seems logical to me that maybe some of that is sort of a little bit extra to allow us to use it for this other purposes.
Fascinating stuff, Jennifer. Great to talk with you. Thanks for being on the program.
Thank you very much.
Jennifer Groh is a Duke professor of neuroscience who has written the book called Making Space, about our brain's ability for spatial processing. Just ahead, a big band spin on a classic Christmas. Nina Freelon joins us with John Brown live in the State of Things. Stay tuned.